Okay, this evening we're going to be continuing our discussion of apologetics. And one of the big things we're going to be talking about is the creation, evolution, I guess we'd say controversy. And we're going to kind of discuss it a little bit this evening with regard to the origin of life. So I'd like you to turn in your Old Testaments to Genesis chapter 1. What I have on this two-page outline is verses at the beginning and verses at the end, and some stuff in the middle that you might not understand, and I may not be able to explain to you, which means that I might not understand it either. But there are some things that I've come across recently, which basically are some arguments to show the problems with the evolutionary model in explaining the origin of life. And I wanted to share a few of those with you. And it's not necessary that you have a full understanding of RNA and DNA and genes and proteins and amino acids and all that kind of thing, but those are kind of the fundamental elements that make up the soup, that make up cells, that evolutionists say made the first life. And the explanation they give as to how it came about is somewhat troublesome. And certainly when it's compared to the simplicity of the Genesis text, gives pause, because there's so much conjecture, so much that the evolutionists, though they claim this is the way it must have happened, they're unsure about. And yet, of course, they reject out of hand the idea of any supernatural intervention or the possibility of that. So that's what we're going to be discussing this evening, and as we get into it, if you have any questions or anything is not clear, you know, I'm much better when I've got a text of scripture in front of me, but when I'm trying to explain scientific arguments, I'll have to admit that I'm kind of out of my element. So if there's anything that's unclear to you at all, just let me know, and we'll try to explain it more clearly, or I'll ask one of the engineers or anybody else who has some of that kind of knowledge to take over from me, and we'll manage to get through it. Okay, if you look at the introduction, the question that we're going to be discussing this evening is basically, where did life come from? How did life come about? And, of course, that impacts us, because that will at least in part answer the question, where do we come from? And, of course, we all believe that we came from God, that God created us. And, of course, when you look at the scripture that we have there at the top of the page, we're referring to the Genesis account of creation. So I would like to begin by reading that, so that we'll have that in front of us, and we could read the entirety of it, but what I basically want to do is emphasize the creation of life in its forms. I did want to start off with Genesis 1:1. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. I think that is an introductory statement concerning the process as it goes on, but also indicates the setting from which the life is derived. But if you'll notice in verses 11 and 12, that's the first statement, said, let's see, the third day. I tried to make sure exactly where it was. The third day, verse 11. God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the third day. So there we find plant life. By the way, just so that you'll kind of have this awareness, there is a controversy that exists even among Christians today as to the legitimacy of the Genesis account as being an historical account of creation. There are some who would say it's not. Again, even some call themselves gospel preachers that basically take issue with the idea of it being a historical account. They will call it a metaphor or I forgot what the term is, but an allegory, I think, is what they were using, of creation. That doesn't mean that they deny that God created, but the idea of six literal days of creation making up the time from which he began his creative work until he ended it, is something that is at issue in the minds of many today. One of the things that lends itself to this idea that these were actually legitimate days is if they were eons, millions of years, epochs in between each day, then that becomes troublesome with regard to the plant life existing first, because as we know, plant life is somewhat dependent upon animal life, and animal life dependent upon plant life, kind of an ecosystem type of situation. If they're only separated by a day or two, that's one thing. If it's something that is separated by millions and millions of years, and then we got a problem. And not only with regard to that, but in fact, in verse 14, it was not until the fourth day that God divided the lights, the firmament of the heaven, to divide the day from the night, and for seasons, for days, and for years. The creation of days in the sense of the sun rising and setting, and the differentiation with regard to the light, was something that did not happen until the fourth day. If that was millions and millions of years after plant life was created, well, then we got a problem. So I think that the context, at least, and I think Jesus himself, in a comment he made in Matthew, the 19th chapter, indicates that this was a creation week, a literal week. You'll remember that Jesus, when he was talking about the formation of the marriage relationship in Matthew chapter 19, God made man and woman. It said, in the beginning, he made them male and female. And in reality, that would not be possible to even in accommodated language say that if man was not created till the sixth day, if we're talking about millions or billions of years in between each day, because that puts man almost at the end of the history of the universe rather than at the beginning of it. And he said in the beginning. And so this is what the book of Genesis is, the book of beginnings, and what we have related in these verses are, again, the creation of the universe, of the world, differentiation of light, and also the creation of the various creatures. So the plant life, verses 11 and 12, in verses 20 and 21, on the fifth day, God said, let the waters abound with abundance of living creatures. Let the birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures, every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So here we have the birds as well as the marine creatures. In verses 24 and 25, we find on the sixth day, God said, let the earth bring forth living creature according to its kind, cattle, creeping thing, and beast of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Also on that sixth day, we're told in verse 26 that God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And after that creative, the pinnacle of his creative work, we're told that God rested on the seventh day. He ceased from his creative work. So that's what we believe. And by the way, if you'll notice under the two bullet points in the introduction, there is a differentiation between theist and atheist. And I wrote atheist that way on purpose, so that you'll know that that is the opposite of a theist. That's what the word atheist means, one who does not believe in God, in contrast to the one that believes in God. Well, Christians are not the only theists. There are many individuals who believe that there is a divine creator, some supernatural source and power that exists in the universe. There are other religions that hold that same position. There are individuals who call themselves, this is the common thing said today, I am spiritual but not religious, who think that there is some first cause out there somewhere. Now, they might not want anything to do with knowing his will. They may want to contend that he did not reveal himself to us. But as they look at the universe with its semblance of design, they naturally come to the conclusion that there must be a designer. And as a result of that, there are many who would be referred to as theists in the sense that they they accept. And some of them, and I don't know if you can really call them theists in this regard, some of them may not even personalize it. Someone or something out there is what you'll hear often. Very nebulous. Again, there's a reason for that, because people don't want to be acknowledging and familiar with and aware of a divine person who makes obligation, who creates an obligation, so that they would have to give account of themselves and how they act. But theism is one extreme. The other is atheism. The evolutionary theory that is so popular, it's taught in our schools. It is considered to be fact by a tremendous number of individuals. That evolutionary theory is atheistic. I do realize that there is what is referred to as theistic evolution. But there's something I want you to understand with regard to theistic evolution. And I'll say this with regard to any aspect of it, a physical or stellar evolution as well as biological evolution, that serious evolutionists ridicule the concept of theistic evolution. That's not across the board. I mean, we have to talk in general, broad categories when we say that. And to be honest, if you are at least a Christian or one who accepts the inspiration of the Bible, and you could put Jews in there as well with regard to the Old Testament, but if you accept the inspiration of Scripture and the accuracy of Scripture, there is no place for evolution in it either. Not the general or broad theory of evolution, that life came about over eons and through a general process of chance and natural selection. The Bible doesn't teach that. It teaches just the opposite. And so when you hear individuals, including the Catholic Pope, who has come out and basically, I'm not sure about this Pope. I think he's even more radically evolutionary than the one previous. But it was the previous Pope that actually was the first one to advocate theistic evolution. And so you hear those out there, and it's getting to the point now to where if you consider the biblical account as being true, then you're basically a radical fundamentalist and looked upon with scorn by the majority of society, or much of society. I won't say the majority, but much of society. So that's where we are with regard to these things. A predominant view is the atheistic view that life came about without any supernatural intervention at all. It just came about. In fact, that's the way you would explain it. It just happened. Now, how did it happen? Well, you'll notice the three points under atheists. When did life originate? Where did life originate? And how did life originate? I don't know if there's any of this that has... No, none of those three points actually have quotations. Now, all of them were taken... the material that's contained in these three points were taken from the University of California, Berkeley website. And it was the curriculum or additions to the curriculum. The page was Evolution 101. So this is basically introductory material that they teach on the subject of evolution. It's on their website. And really what I tried to do with most of this, there are some quotes, but most of it is an attempt to summarize, because otherwise I would have been handing out 20 pages of articles and things like that, and I felt it best just to try to summarize. So if you've been reading it ahead of time and it's not making any sense, hopefully by adding some things to it I might help you. But anyway, the three questions that are under the, or three of the questions that were under consideration is when, where, and how did life originate? Well, the when is, according to evolutionists, is 3.5 billion years ago. Now again, that date is something that is absolutely irreconcilable with the biblical account. If you accept the Bible account of creation, you cannot get 3.5 billion years in there. It's not possible. As we already alluded to, the problems with the concept of the multiple days. It's just not allowed in the Hebrew. There's no just cause for inserting gaps in between the days. There are problems with the gap theory or the long day theories as a result of the interaction of creation. The only reason to try to put it in there is because of a desire to reconcile evolution with the creation account. And you really can't do it. And so if we're going to accept the inspiration of Scripture, we've got to deny that 3.5 billion years.
Yes. Does it jive with any religion, Muslim, Hindu, anything, do any religions have a grasp of it, or do all religions pretty much say that? No, there's no way.
Are you saying, I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Well, I mean, if you were a Hindu or a Shinto, or, I mean, if you were any religion, does any of their religions
allow for evolution?
Yeah, or not?
I really don't know. I would imagine some do, but for the most part, when you're talking about religions, you're talking about beliefs in gods, which would bring about the idea of supernatural intervention, which would be opposite of evolution. As far as the age process, you were nodding your head, Jonathan. Are you aware of
people? Well, at least the ones, a couple of them mentioned, the Hindu in particular, is more of a life philosophy aspect.
Buddhism is as
well. And they focus on scientific evidences to explain the world around, with religious connotations to describe morality or dictate morality. So the Hindus you speak with are perfectly fine with evolution.
Yeah, wouldn't have a problem with
it. However long it took. And if you look at some of the Muslim writings, they have it structured as well to where their faith can accommodate scientific advancements, as they put it. That God created them to direct a further study in the world around them. So wherever science leads them is where science would take them.
Well, that is a dangerous thing as far as... And this is something since we brought it up, something to kind of make note of. When I talk about the problems that we find in the church with regard to these things, most of you are aware of the fact, maybe not all, but most of you are aware of the fact that a number of years ago, there was a discussion, a controversy that existed that came about because there was a particular Bible teacher. He's in the Bible department at Florida College, who, when he was teaching from the Genesis account, gave as a plausible possibility the day-age theory, which is a day, each day equals a long period of time. Now, he wasn't advocating that exclusively. It is his own personal belief, but he did introduce it to his students, which caused a lot of controversy. And as a result of that, at that point in time, I was still editing Watchman magazine, and there was a discussion that went on in the magazine. And not only was the discussion in the magazine, and it was a profitable discussion, it's still up there if you want to take the time to read it sometime in the future. But also, I got a lot of emails. I got a lot of emails from people very angry with me because I was putting that discussion up and critical of that particular teacher. And not me, but others as well. And there were a number of individuals who basically were saying we're putting our head in the sand if we teach a young earth position. And the reason why is because, in their view, the evidence was too strong against that. The scientific evidence was too strong to accept the young earth view. And without any exception, all of these individuals were taking what men say about the universe through the physical sciences and all, and they were interpreting the Bible in light of the science of the day. Now, people have done that for generations and generations and generations and come into problems with regard to it. There are individuals who believe that the sun revolved around the earth based upon their interpretation of Scripture. But what they were doing is taking a superstition of the day and trying to make the Bible text, which basically was just talking about how man's the pinnacle of God's creation, to interpret that to mean that we're at the center of the universe. And so whenever you use the science of the day or the beliefs of the day to interpret the Bible, you got a problem. It's a very dangerous thing to do. We as Christians have to keep in mind the mindset with regard to Bible interpretation, let God be true and every man a liar, and recognize the inerrancy and inspiration of Scripture. And that's not to say that we can't be scientists, because we certainly can. There are a lot of Bible-believing scientists. There are a lot of young earth creationist scientist as well, but what it does mean is it's a very dangerous thing to say, well, they're saying this and it seems to be so, and so this part of the Bible that I've always understood in this way, it must not be that way. And when we begin doing that, interpreting, we interpret the Bible in light of nature. We got a problem. Nature does not testify. God testifies. Nature in Psalm 19:1, all it can testify as to the existence of God. It doesn't testify as to how God brought the worlds into existence. That's something that is revealed through His will. And we need to keep that idea straightforward as far as the process, or else we'll run into problems, and that's happened quite a few times. Okay, so the date, 3.5 billion years, that's obviously not the date of the date they hold with regard to the beginnings of the universe, but it is about the date that they think that that life first evolved. Now, where did it originate? You've always heard the primordial sea. You've heard that phrase, the primordial sea. And I want you to kind of understand what basically scientists are saying, is that over a period of time, organic molecules formed, proteins, sugars, nucleotides, amino acids, all of these formed by chance, and then eventually a cell membrane formed around them, and then we had a life in the first. And so it's basically a soup in the sea, is what they're thinking. As time progressed, more and more of these organic materials gathered, and that there was the application of heat, most probably, and as a result of that, life sprang forth. Okay, that's kind of the idea. So you're not going to hear about life appearing in the air. You have people who, by the way, who believe that life was created possibly in other parts of the universe and just traveled here in some way or form. How many times have we heard about those rocks? I've never understood why this is the case. Okay, we've got a rock. The rock flies. I don't know how it got there from here from there. But it flies from Mars and it lands on Earth. So we've got a Mars rock that we've uncovered in the ground. Pick it up, crack it open. It looks like there may be some animals. So this is where life on Earth came from. Well, why is that? Why does it have to go that way? Why can't it be that life was here on Earth, the rock flew there, and maybe flew back? I mean, I don't understand why it has to be Mars, you know, but that's the idea. Men are really wanting to know where life came from. They want to have a naturalistic explanation as to where it came from. Well, the most popular one right now is that it originated near a deep-sea hydrothermal vent. And the reason why is because there are some fossil animals, not animals, but fossil organisms, and I forget now what they're called, I should have written it down. So fossil organisms that are very, very close to the most simple organisms that we have on Earth today. They're very similar in structure, same group. And they found them near these hydrothermal vents. So you got heat, and you've got proof that there, you know, in the fossils that there was some animals like that back then. So maybe that's where it happened. And because of the great pressure, because of the great heat, you see that there's a couple of things that have to happen in their view of creation of life. You have to have the materials, which would be the proteins, RNA, DNA. We'll talk about that in a moment. And you also have to have some energy. Remember Frankenstein, his monster? You know, the electricity hit it, and he's alive. Well, you know, that's silly, but I mean, in effect, in a sense, that's what's necessary, is there has to be the insertion of some kind of energy in order for all this to form and come into bar. So the deep-sea hydrothermal vent is what is commonly believed today, or some tide pool or a hot spring or something like that. The how did life originate? There are five steps, according to Evolution 101 in Berkeley. First thing is there was the organic molecules that formed. Now again, there is absolutely no description or mechanism that is given as to how it happened. And there can't be, really. I mean, there are certain things that they can replicate. For example, they have been able, as far back as 1953, they've been able, under careful laboratory conditions, if you get exactly the right soup together and you put in exactly the right amount of energy, they've been able to form amino acids. So they have been able to replicate I don't think they've ever claimed fully to replicate life, but they have been able to replicate amino acids and proteins, things like that, in the laboratory. Maybe the laboratory too, I don't know. In the laboratory. But anyway, so these simple organic molecules formed, and that's the RNA. Actually, the belief is the RNA molecules were the first to form. That's what they believe. DNA came later. But a DNA molecule is a simple organic molecule. So this is a genetic material for all life. And by the way, just to make this point as well, when Charles Darwin came upon the scene back in the 1800s, was it mid-1800s? Seemed like that, right? Mid-1850s, I think. When he came onto the scene in the 1800s, we didn't have microscopes. We didn't have electron microscopes. We did not have diagnostic tools like we have today, the ability to dissect and to examine on a microscopic level. All we had was gross skills. You heard of gross anatomy. That basically means looking at the big stuff. And that's all that was available. So you had diversity in life, but there wasn't any real knowledge of the workings of life. And when he began his explanation of the survival of the fittest and this concept of evolutionary process, you know, the idea was the more we know and more we learn, the mechanisms are going to become obvious. And it's going to be easy to understand how this is all accomplished. But in reality, the more and more we learn, the more and more complex it gets. The human genome, the DNA strand, and what it constitutes, and all of those kinds of things are things that Charles Darwin had absolutely no idea about. But what that means is, even at the smallest level, a cell, with regard to a single cell in our body, it consists of, or is, an amazingly complex organism. And so it's amazing how complex it is when you get to the discussion of these kinds of things. So the first thing is the RNA forms. And then the second thing is that it becomes necessary for these organic molecules to replicate themselves. Okay? It has to make more and more copies of itself. Now that doesn't necessarily constitute life, but there is an evolutionary process to where some of these organisms, these RNA molecules that form, begin to have the ability to replicate and copy the genetic material, pass it on, and so there is more and more and more of these things. And this is a point that, again, this is not necessarily the exact words, but the sentiment of this site. The ability to copy the molecules that encode genetic information is a key step to the origin of life. Without it, life could not exist. So this idea of the replication of the RNA molecule is something that is extremely important, and they contend actually took place. The third is the replicating molecules became enclosed within the cell membrane. Now, through all this, when it said, how did life originate, it never told me at what point it was alive in that paragraph. So I'm not exactly sure. I'm thinking maybe that it's alive now. It's got a membrane around it. But this was the first time they mentioned the survival of the fittest, or natural selection, because if a cell membrane were to form around some of these, they would be more likely to survive and to replicate and carry on. They would have an advantage over the ones that didn't have the cell membrane around them. You can come get it if you want to.
Sorry.
Well, that's fine. I just can't ever remember. It's not a good setup. I got to get somebody else to do that. Okay, so there is the third point. And then fourth, some cells began to evolve modern metabolic processes and outcompeted the older forms of metabolism. In other words, this is where DNA comes in. And since DNA was better than the predecessors, DNA won out, and that's why all life now has DNA. So that's kind of the concept there. And then finally, multicellularity evolved as early as 2 billion years ago. So the first 1.5 billion years is in this process of getting to the point where you've got single cells. The last 2 billion years, from there until today, we have the multiplicity of life. But that's what there is. Some cells stop going their separate ways. In other words, instead they replicated, they evolved specialized functions, they stayed together, and then we have multicellular animals. So this is organisms. So this is evolutionary theory. This is the idea. Again, it's could have, might have, probably, those kinds of things are in all through all of it, because just like what we admit to with regard to the biblical account of creation, we accept it by faith because we weren't there. Well, they weren't there either. And there's no way they can know for sure exactly where it happened, how it happened, or when it happened. Okay? So, what I would like to do is just spend a few moments going over two articles that I read recently. And I'm not going to try to go into detail, but if I'm confusing you too much, raise your hand and we'll try to help you with it. The first problem with that model is oxygen. And the reason why is because when it comes to the proteins, amino acids, those kinds of things, the free oxygen, which makes up a part of our atmosphere, degrades those things. In other words, it is destructive to those things. Now, oxygen is not destructive to life, necessarily. But in a free state, in an open state, they're destructive. It degrades those kinds of amino acids and proteins and sugars and those kinds of things. So oxygen is an enemy to the origin of life. Not an enemy to us, because we got to breathe it. But when life was first coming about, oxygen's a problem. And there are actually many scientists who believe that early in the history of the Earth, there was no free oxygen. I'm not saying there wasn't any at all, there just wasn't any. In fact, you know, you hear about things about comets hitting the Earth, and that's where water comes from. And, of course, water is made up in part in oxygen and those kinds of things. There's all that kind of thing out there. But there's a dilemma with regard to the oxygen, because if oxygen is destructive to these things, it's a problem if there's no oxygen as well. And the reason for that is because of the destructive nature of raw energy. What we have today is O2 oxygen. We also have O3. You may know what O3 is? It's ozone. You've heard of ozone. The ozone layer is thinning, or there's a hole in the ozone layer. Well, the ozone's important because it manages to filter out ultraviolet light, which can cause cancer and all sorts of problems. And it's something that is likewise destructive. It is destructive to organic molecules. If there wasn't any ozone layer at all, then the ultraviolet light would destroy the organic molecules. Now, again, I have absolutely no doubt, and really, it's hard for me to go through and, okay, here's an argument made, now let me go find the refutation of that, and then let me go see how we answer that refutation and go through all these things. And there may be a few answers for some of these arguments that are made. In other words, he may have gotten something wrong, or there may be an explanation that could come forth that an evolutionist would have. What I want you to understand based on this is that when these evolutionists with all the letters behind their name pontificate, in effect, that evolution is a fact, this is how it happened, that there are problems with what they're saying, a lot of problems with what they're saying. I'm just giving you a couple of examples, okay? Anybody want to add to or question that first one? Did I make it? Oxygen's a problem, lack of oxygen's a problem. So you got a problem with that model because of, okay? All right, second one. All forms of raw energy are destructive. Think about, we're talking about the primeval Earth. What was there? You know, we're talking about you need energy. What energy's there? You got the sun, you got lightning, you got the radioactive decay that might be present with regard to some isotopes. I mean, platinum, plutonium. Excuse me. I don't think platinum is radioactive. It might be light, a little bit, not very. Anyway, so that kind of energy tend to degrade rather than form amino acids. Same kind of problem. And again, this goes back to, well, we've been able to develop amino acids. And I don't understand how this is, but with regard to that 1953 experiment that I was reading about there, he was able to form amino acids by putting this soup together with all the right ingredients. But in order for the amino acids to remain amino acids, he had to put them into a trap, separating them from the energy that was used to form them. Because if the energy had remained, they would have degraded. In other words, they couldn't have lasted. They couldn't have lived, or not lived, but continued in that same form, because the heat, or the sun, or the lightning, if you want to use Frankenstein's monster, all those things would degrade it, or have that tendency to degrade. So these arguments, and they come from Internet Creation Research .org, and a specific article. Dwayne Gish is the writer. He has a PhD. I don't know what. But anyway, if you want to read the article on your own, you certainly can. All right? Can, guys, if any of you know that there's a problem with any of these, then tell me what it is, or speak up. Third one.
Well, so back on how life originates, you said that natural selection doesn't really take effect until the third step where you have a cell membrane, but your paragraph on 2 says the natural selection started back with the replicated molecules.
I misspoke then.
The oxygen dilemma.
What I was saying basically is the first time I read in the paragraph in the you used the Berkeley stuff. I don't know if that's the first time it's mentioned. It seems like that's the first time I'm reading.
The oxygen dilemma. I mean, it's a ton more complicated. You're saying oxygen's not harmful to life. It's certainly harmful to life.
Rust.
Like if you leave.
Yeah.
Well, there's rust, but if you leave an apple core out. It oxidizes, right?
Okay.
Well, we oxidize. You're oxidizing right now because you have oxygen all around you.
Is that the free radicals we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
And when you go and you breathe, your body sends a bunch of oxygen to your cells and it goes into the mitochondria and all that, but it doesn't get it all there. I mean, it's pretty efficient. It gets, 98% of it or something there. But some of it gets loose in your body and wreaks havoc on your DNA or whatever else it happens to come in contact with. So the real point of it is that our body takes the various forms of energy that it gets and the oxygen that it gets, and it constantly is repairing itself, right? It repairs itself against the oxygen. It repairs itself against the ultraviolet light from the sun. It sits there repairing itself. So the question is, all right, how are these things going to repair themselves? Or are they going to destroy themselves as far as the cell membranes go? That's why the stuff about the thermal vents under the ocean seems to make sense to folk, because ozone provides a pretty good layer to protect you from radiations, things like that. Also, 5 miles of ocean provides a pretty good layer to protect you from ultraviolet light. So there's not a whole lot of light happening down at these thermal vents.
Sure.
So the radiation doesn't really come into play as far as the production of light down at those levels.
Okay. All right. Y'all get that? And by the way, Justin, Jonathan, I want to set you toward, y'all just, you guys intimidate me a little bit because y'all have the engineering degrees and that kind of stuff. There are others probably in here that have that same background. But read those articles for me, if you will, and just let me know what you think about them. And whether or not my summary is sufficiently good to be at least fairly accurate. The third point, and by the way, one thing that Justin referred to is letter D, the fourth point, that I'll make note of in a second. But the third point is the idea of a spontaneously self-replicating molecule. Talking about going back to point 2 up there under how did life originate, the replicating molecules, RNA molecules. And this is where I put a quote from the article. To form a protein in a laboratory, the chemist dissolves the required amino acids in a solvent. He adds a chemical that contains high energy bonds, referred to as a peptide reagent. The energy from this chemical is transferred to the amino acids, and that provides the necessary energy to form chemical bonds between amino acids, releases hydrogen and oxygen-hydrogen molecule to form water. This only happens in a chemistry laboratory in the cells of living organisms. It could never have taken place in the primitive ocean or anywhere on a primitive Earth. And that's what he contends in regard to this. And the idea, though, of spontaneously self-replicating RNA molecules is not something that has been observed in nature. That's what he's contending there. And then the fourth one. I thought I was going to get through all this, but I'm not going to. Okay. The fourth one is that DNA could not survive without repair mechanisms. And this is kind of an interesting point. Justin's talking about how the body repairs itself. We've got functions inside our body to repair damage that is done by oxidation, free radicals, those kinds of things. The interesting thing about this is that if you look in the human gene, there are over 130 DNA human repair genes that have been discovered, but scientists believe there are many more than that he has not come across yet. So 130 genes in DNA that their specific purpose is to repair damage. That's what they exist there for. And according to scientists, the instability of the DNA genome, instability, is caused by the great variety of DNA damaging agents, one of which is water, by the way. and there are many others that exist, oxygen, other things like that. It would be an overwhelming problem for cells if it weren't for DNA repair. In other words, if you didn't have the DNA genes, then DNA would be unstable. It wouldn't work. And so now you've got a problem with which came first, chicken or the egg type thing. In order for DNA to exist and to exist in a stable form, it's dependent upon itself. It's dependent upon DNA. And to look at that final quote there, it would have been impossible for ordinary DNA to evolve before DNA repair genes had evolved. And so this is another, as he puts it, an impossible barrier for evolution. Okay? So that's what we're going to finish with. The other thing is the other article, which we'll talk about next week, and I'll have some other material ready as well, is with regard to the staggering odds of as a result of the complexity of the human cell that it could have come about without divine intervention or divine direction. Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit. It's another article that appeared on that site. What I would like you to do, because we're going to also talk about the law of biogenesis and the teleological argument, we're going to spend some time to get back into Scripture in regard to it. But under the law of biogenesis, I want you to look at the second paragraph in that law of biogenesis, and we'll kind of finish with that. This is actually from Wikipedia, so, you know, it is what it is. But it says the term biogenesis was coined by Henry Charlton Bastian to mean the generation of a life form from non-living materials. However, Thomas Henry Huxley chose the term abiogenesis and redefined biogenesis for life arising from pre-existing life. In other words, biogenesis is what we observe. Biogenesis was what was proven by Louis Pasteur. Y'all remember when you were in school talking about Pasteur's experiments. He put he sterilized glasses or beakers or whatever. He put stew in them, and he covered them up with a clean cloth, and then he left others open because the view was that larvae and flies spontaneously generate out of that broth. And it certainly did generate out of the broth that was uncovered, but not the one that was covered, because the flies were laying the eggs, and it's just something that wasn't observed. So anyway, Louis Pasteur says spontaneous generation doesn't happen. And that's kind of the law of biogenesis. That's what it's called. Well, it's been redefined, however. You've got the law of biogenesis, which is, instead of all life comes from life, biogenesis is life coming from life, but there is an abiogenesis. Notice the material that's in boldface. The generation of life from non-living material is called abiogenesis and has occurred at least once in the history of the earth or in the history of the universe. See panspermia. I'm assuming that's the theory that life originated elsewhere in the universe and traveled to earth. When life first arose. Now, I want you. The reason I boldface that is that it is an assertion. It's not proof. And it's not something that they have shown to be so. What they're saying is, life doesn't come from non-life. It doesn't. Louis Pasteur has proven that. But once it did, at least once it has happened. That's exactly what happened once. It happened either somewhere on the earth, or it happened somewhere in the universe, because if it hadn't have happened, we wouldn't be here. Okay? So again, they're not sure about what's going on or how it's happening or anything, but they're sure that's the way it's got to be, because it can't be God. If you're an evolutionist, you're an atheistic evolutionist, it can't be God. And if it can't be God, it must have happened, even though we've got through observation that it doesn't happen. It must have. That's the idea that, and that's why the law of biogenesis, I think, is significant in this regard. Okay, thank you very much for your kind attention today, and we'll pick up with point number two at the top of the second page.